infected. Yet in spite of all this, Boris Johnson's able to find himself in front of the cameras, claiming that he'll not let the British people suffer, or the children go hungry.
Well, let's be absolutely clear. We're going to make sure that we have no children, no kids, no pupils in our country who go hungry this winter, certainly not as a result of any government inattention. We're focusing on that, as we have done very, very hard over the last few months, and we've given, you know, huge sums to local councils to help them out, but also specific sums for helping with meals during what was a very disrupted period.
Yet with Britain clearly becoming the laughing stock of Europe, it seems that the only way to judge the Conservative government of Boris Johnson is through humour, which, as seen in this picture, shows Johnson's front bench openly mocking the situation British children find themselves in. The point, however, that Johnson should be most worried about is, why did it take a Manchester United football player to raise the issue that children are going hungry? Surely this should have been the job of the UK government. And as Marcus Rashford continues to fire on all cylinders, it seems that Boris Johnson is missing the target.
The French president has faced a huge backlash in his views against Islam. Emmanuel Macron's comments on the denunciation of Islam and in defense of secularism have drawn widespread backlash from Muslim activists and advocates of the noble religion. Iran's foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has denounced France's stance on insults to Muslims and their sanctities, saying such moves are opportunistic abuse of freedom of speech that would only fuel extremism. Zarif also added that Muslims are the primary victims of the cult of hatred that has been empowered by colonial regimes. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, also advised the French president to read more history and not to rejoice in the support of a declining America and Zionism.
I mean, it's quite clear, like, we know that, like, everybody knows the history of what France did in Algeria, okay? They occupied that place for 200 years, humiliating, mass murdering, massacres, you know, breaching Islamic laws, and, disrespecting the Muslims as a whole. And they've also, you know, done a lot of colonial projects inside France in different areas.
Iran has also summoned the French chargé d'affaires to protest the anti-Muslim comments by the country's president. Meanwhile, Muslims have attended protests in Bangladesh, Iraq, Palestine, Pakistan, and many other countries, calling for a boycott of French goods. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has criticized Macron, saying the French leader needed mental checks over his attitude towards Islam. A boycott of French products is already underway in supermarkets in the Persian Gulf kingdoms of Qatar and Kuwait. It's also been demanded in Jordan and Turkey. Macron has unveiled a plan to defend France's secular values against what he labeled as Islamist radicalism. He's also claimed that the religion was in crisis all over the world. Macron has underlined that no concessions would be made in a new drive to eliminate religion from education and the public sector in the country. The French president also said his government would present a bill in December that would strengthen the country's law that officially separated religion and state. Macron's plans also include restricting funds that Muslim communities receive from abroad, supposedly limiting foreign influence.
As he sees these cartoons and these despicable pictures defaming and disrespecting a highly important figure for Muslims, one of the most highest figures, the Prophet Muhammad, and, you know, with no regards to these people's feelings. So, you know, we're talking about French Muslim citizens, and we're talking about the Muslims in the world. We're talking about 1.9 billion Muslims that are affected by this. You know,
Macron's comments came less than a month after Muslim protesters censured Charlie Hebdo, a French weekly satirical magazine, for its recent reprinting of blasphemous caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. A second event, the killing of teacher Samuel Paty, who had shown the blasphemous cartoons in his class, has led to further upset. While Muslims condemned the gruesome killing, the response from French officials had been perceived as linking Islam with terrorism. There are also fears of collective punishment.
I mean, it's not in the interest of France because they have a majority of Muslims compared to the whole West. I mean, they have the biggest population of Muslims in the Western world.
It's believed Macron needs to fight systemic racism in his country and provide opportunities for Muslims who have been radicalized at the margins of French society. It's also been suggested that Macron's secularist push is partly efforts to gain votes in the upcoming elections. The rise of far-right ideology and the propagation of anti-immigration policies have exacerbated the status of religious minorities in France.
A knife-wielding assailant terrorized France on Thursday. The 21-year-old man brutally stabbed several people to death at the Notre Dame Basilica in Nice. The horrendous stabbing had echoes of another attack earlier this month in the capital, in which a teacher was beheaded after having shown pupils cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. French President Emmanuel Macron was quick on Thursday to denounce the attack in Nice as an act of, quote, Islamist terrorism. The deadly knife attack comes as France is mired in an escalating row with Muslim nations over Macron's highly controversial approach towards Islam and Muslims in France. The row has been fueled by Macron's defense of cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad, which Muslims consider blasphemous. The French president says free speech and secular values are his red lines. He has pledged to push ahead with his plan to combat, quote, Islamist separatism. The French president insists that Islam is in crisis all over the world and that radical Muslim positions are hardening. Muslim leaders and scholars have condemned terrorist attacks in France, but have warned that provocative comments by Macron are fueling hatred and extremism. Muslims argue that a line must be drawn between free speech and insult to religions. Meanwhile, the United Nations warned on Thursday that insulting religions provokes violent extremism, leading to fragmentation of the society. But Macron is not listening at all. Why is he refusing to see that his deeply divisive statements are somehow destroying what's left of tolerance in the French society? The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, called the French president's defense of the blasphemous cartoons a stupid act. The leader said French people should ask their president why he supports insulting God's messenger in the name of freedom of expression. Iran's foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif condemned the terrorist attack in Nice. Zarif said hate speech, provocations and violence must be replaced by reason and sanity. Meanwhile, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who has been outspoken in his condemnation of Macron, says Western countries attacking Islam want to relaunch the Crusades. Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan urged Muslim leaders this week to act collectively to counter growing Islamophobia in non-Muslim states. Anti-France sentiments are running high in Muslim countries around the globe. There have been protests in many Muslim countries, including Indonesia, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, and Libya, which drew hundreds of thousands of demonstrators. Traders and people in many countries are boycotting French goods in response to France's anti-Islam campaign. Politicians in Europe have, however, been reluctant to acknowledge that radical statements and stances by top European officials are fueling the flames of extremism. Many European leaders have rallied around Macron and criticized attacks on him. The ongoing tensions may abate in the coming days or weeks, but they are likely to rise again in the future if politicians and top officials fail to respect religions and listen to reason.
We'll be right back.
The United States have quite simply failed when it comes to their maximum pressure and foreign policies when it comes to Iran, having essentially failed to destabilize or demotivate the people of the country. So much so that some reports state that sanctions have only achieved 3.4% of the effect that they were intended to have on the country and its institutions. It's hence why the US National Security Advisor, Robert O'Brien, has claimed that there are few new sanctions left to impose on Tehran, as it appears that all options have run out for the Americans, who have no tactics left on the table when it comes to their attempts to bully Iran into following a so-called American line of democracy. O'Brien also included Russia in his speech, stating that the number of sanctions placed on both nations have exceeded the policy strategies plans left for the nation. With the option of heading into a conflict highly unlikely, both Russia and Iran have shown that weak US policies are starting to fail as emerging powers breeze through the conditions imposed on them by the Americans. The US has also announced that both Russia and Iran, as well as China, have all played a part in trying to influence the outcome of the upcoming US elections, something that all three nations have waved off as nonsense, with Iran stating that it has no need to interfere with any nation's internal affairs, raising the question as to where the US claims such allegations might come from. Currently around the world, the US has imposed sanctions on 30 different states, ranging from West Asia, with the likes of Iran, Yemen, and Syria, to the Far East, with North Korea being a prime target. But with sanctions clearly being deemed to be ineffective, why then does the US continue to insist that it places futile sanctions on global nations around the world?
It's very interesting how the United States continues to do, even from their point of view, ineffective tactics. We've seen this in relation with Cuba, where for more than 60 years until President Obama decided to try a different tactic, there was a completely ineffective, from their point of view, blockade on Cuba, and they continue to do it and continue to do it to today. It's like they have nothing else to do but to create destruction and hardship for people, hoping that somehow this failed policy will work.
Once bitten, twice shy. It's one of the world's oldest proverbs and clearly demonstrates the amount of trust the Iranians currently give the Americans, as on multiple occasions throughout recent history, the US has shown that treaties, agreements and accords are worth nothing more than the paper they're written on, as the US pull out at will when it suits them. So why then would Iran want to enter talks with such a nation? The rhetoric coming out of Washington is interesting when it comes to Iran, with both the Republicans and the Democrats apparently both agreeing that sanctions are the preferred option when it comes to dealing with Iran. Although, with the sanctions clearly not working, what other options are available to the next US president?
Biden has said that he would continue basically the Obama approach, that he would renegotiate with Iran and find ways of reinstituting the former agreement that Trump, withdrew from unilaterally. And also the other thing that Biden has said is that he would, make sure that whatever sanctions were in place would not impact Iran's ability to deal with the COVID crisis.
For Trump, the notion that Biden might be the next president is something that he clearly fears, and hence why he's seeking to place even further pressure on Iran in a way that could be harder to reverse if Biden does win the White House. For Biden, however, he claims that there's a smarter way to be tough on Iran, although there have been rumors that Biden would consider re-entering the JCPOA, something that could in fact see a lifting of sanctions against Iran and paving the way for sensible diplomacy. But at the end of the day, the rhetoric on Iran by both candidates is something that still remains a pre-election talking point aimed at gaining votes. The true answer to what happens next will come to light at the end of January next year, when a new or incumbent president takes his oath in Washington.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The unfair market practices of technology giants Google and Facebook is pushing local journalism over the edge, according to a new report from the office of Senator Maria Cantwell, a Democrat from Washington State. The report released recently predicts that by the end of 2020, U.S. newspaper revenue will be down 70% compared to 20 years ago, and broadcast revenues will dip more than 40%. The losses have created news deserts in 200 counties across the United States where there are no local newspapers covering their communities. More than 40,000 newsroom employees have been laid off, 60% of the nation's local journalism jobs, according to the report. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stancil Ryder. This article is published under the heading Senator's report finds Google and Facebook have hijacked local news and undermined journalism. Here's the details of this article. The unfair market practices of technology giants Google and Facebook have decimated local journalism, threatening America's most trusted news sources, according to a new report from the office of Senator Maria Cantwell. The Washington State Democrat published a report on Tuesday, October 27th, one day before the CEOs of Google, Facebook, and Twitter testified in a hearing held by the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation. The report describes how irreplaceable local news outlets are being destroyed not only by devastating loss of print advertising revenue caused by the internet transformation of information consumption patterns, but also by massive technology companies' domination of the marketplace for online advertising. Local news has been hijacked by a few large news aggregation platforms, most notably Google and Facebook. The report argues, these trillion-dollar companies scrape local news content and data for their own sites and leverage their market dominance to force local news to accept little to no compensation for their intellectual property. There is a clear need, Cantwell adds, for Congress to address the market failures created by the search and social media platforms. According to Cantwell's analysis, the total revenue of the local journalism industry has declined by 70% since 2000, while local broadcasters have lost more than 40% out of advertising revenues over the same time period. The coronavirus crisis is worsening an already alarming situation, jeopardizing the long-term future of local newspapers, TV, and radio broadcasters. These losses are creating news deserts, the report notes, pointing out that 40,000 newsroom employees, 60% of journalistic workforce, have been laid off over the past two decades, with 7,000 more cuts expected this year, a frightening trend that is leading to thousands fewer watchdogs exposing corruption and keeping elected officials accountable for their constituents. Although Americans want and appreciate the accurate and unbiased reporting that local journalists provide, Cantwell writes, 200 counties nationwide lack newspaper coverage of their communities, while half of all U.S. counties are down to just one, a problem that is particularly acute in the South. The report documents how giant search and social media platforms' unfair, deceptive, and abusive practices have contributed to troubling revenue losses and employment trends that are stifling local journalism. The platforms' continued practices of taking publishers' online content without proper compensation, diverting user traffic away from local news websites, and using formats like accelerated mobile pages or AMP to obtain data about local news consumers are unfair and abusive practices the Federal Trading Commission needs to enforce against, Canfield writes. The lawmaker's report includes an image illustrating how Google's AMP and Facebook's instant articles formats harm local journalism, even as newspapers complying with content hosting requirements. As the Seattle Times reported, Cantwell recommends Congress require that Facebook and Google negotiate payment terms with local media outlets for the headlines, photos, and summaries driving a sizable amount of traffic on their sites. A move proposed or enacted in some European countries and Australia, much to the chagrin of the big tech giants. Congressional action is needed to help local news survive the global pandemic, an onslaught of unfair practices by the dominant online platforms, the report argues, echoing a watershed antitrust lawsuit filed recently against Google by the Justice Department. Local news, said Cantwell, needs new laws and regulations to make sure it can compete fairly and provide its true value to local communities and democracy.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم This is your host Mehdi with brother Habib over here
السلام عليكم How Welcome. Are you all doing?
I'm good I don't know about the rest of the people Hope they're good as well
Hopefully
The program is Youth Station at IRIB English Radio We talk about different things over here Things that you might come across every day So let's see what we can talk about today I guess about ourselves as youth What are we at the perfect time to make a difference in the world?
Really depends what you're trying to say here. Are you saying that us as youths, are we responsible? Every generation has its own youths. And as Muslim youths, for example, like, no, I don't know, between 16 and 30, you could call them youths, right? After 30, you begin to retire from football.
Yeah.
So I'm going to say that. Of course, you know, we have like football players who are retiring from 39 years old. They're not retiring yet, they're still playing.
Yeah, stubborn people.
Yeah. So I think that personally, when you look at this question, us youth 16 to 30, do we have a duty? Because I remember my father was talking about how the young people usually don't go into politics until they reach a certain age.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we see it very rarely that a young person comes and becomes president.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we have a president in, like, you know, our time that was like 23 years old or 24 years old. Even though, like, I personally believe that there are some youth who are smarter than those, you know, experienced people, although their experience is kind of vital for us. So I think that in our age, we have energy. Mm. We have the power.
Motivation.
Yeah, motivation and whatnot. And we're setting up a future not only for us as elderly members of the community, but we're also setting it up for our children to come and generations to come. So I think that not only the youth have a role to play in
their own society,
in our society, in our environment, but I think that the role that the youth has is different to the youth of the elder and the younger generations. So, for example, like conducting some actions, you know, they might be on the field more.
Yeah.
Like, for example, yeah. I don't know, troops, you could say. And, for example, they're the ones that start the petitions or start the, I don't know, how to say, movements. For example, let's say that we want to build a forest. We want to make a forest for our community.
Yeah, youth can actually do it themselves rather than
depending. Yeah, but we just need, like, for example, a permit or whatnot, and that really needs, you know, the political experience or the political heads.
That's what I got reminded of when you said that we don't have a youth as a president, for example.
Yeah.
Well, that's partly or maybe mostly the problem with the system, isn't it?
Really, I personally think that the more the person is elder, the more experience he gives.
Right.
I think experience is very vital. We could have, like, advisors, true, like a young person and being advised. But how about, like, two older people who are both experienced, one advising the other?
But then there's a council. For example, a president has a council.
Yeah.
The council can have, like, all these elderly, full of experienced people over there. But the thing is, the youth aren't even given the room to enter that field of, for example, politics or something that's seen as a vital course or field in a society. The youth are kept away from that. And they themselves also have this impression that, you know, we...
I don't think that they're kept away from it. I think that they keep themselves away from it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, I think that they can. They can run, they can. But the thing here is that truly and verily, I really believe this, that when running a country or having a rulership, you need to have experience. You need to know, because experience teaches you a lot of things. And I'm pretty sure that there might be examples out there. I'm not sure. I've read about examples a long time ago.
Yeah.
That a young king would always lose his kingdom. Go ahead and look at the history of young kings.
How old was Alexander?
Like, for example, like 12 years old. I don't know. Something like that. Other than Alexander.
I think he was young.
Yeah, he was young. He was young when he got the throne. He was like 12 or 16 or 14. Something.
A prodigy, wasn't
he?
Yeah.
Those are few. Those are rare, actually.
Yeah, you're right.
So I think that whenever someone young comes to the rule, it's much easier to take away. It's much easier to take away.
And but like, it's a government now. It's not a kingdom, you know, like...
Nowadays, I think that... I have this theory that we're saying that it's a new government and whatnot, but I think it's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. Rulership and power, conquer and divide and do whatever you want. And, you know, you lived in some countries that, you know, took some other countries, and then after hundreds of years, they're like, we're sorry, bye-bye, and then taking what they need.
Yeah.
So I personally believe, like how I said, that we can, as youth, become politically engaged, but we lack experience.
For example, after 50 years, a child comes up to his father and he says, when you were 18, for example, or from 18 to 20-something, this happened in your time. Where were you? What did you lot do? Now, that's a question as a person... At that time, for example, right now, me, I see that some countries are politically conquering other countries, and other countries are actually supporting them.
That's the oppression, yeah.
Yeah, the oppression, you know. What I'm saying is, me as a person right now, one person, right, 1 + 1 = 2, and 2 + 2 = 4, that leads to a lot. But the thing is, what do I do? What can I do that I'm held responsible tomorrow?
First of all, we have to acknowledge what is our responsibility. That's very important. What is our responsibility? Is our responsibility when another country wants to oppress my country, is it my responsibility as a person who is not inside that political field to come and defend? Or it is. Do I have to wear, for example, my weapons or my shield and go defend my land? What is my responsibility?
Yeah, what is it?
That's the thing. From every scenario or situation, it differs. It could be, for example, a buff guy like you and a skinny guy like me, and then and all of a sudden we are in the war, and
there,
we need like two. We need two, like a pilot, and
he's
we need
like
a person
thrice
to
my
hold.
Size right now. You know? Anyway, yeah,
we need like a sword and heavy metal and whatnot to hold. So, what is your responsibility? What is my responsibility? As a skinny guy, I'm the pilot. As the buff guy, you are. You're gonna hold that heavy metal for me, and then we're gonna drive, and then you're gonna
That's one of the problems. Why we're facing what we're facing, you know.
Yeah, it's very important for us to understand our responsibilities, first of all. What are our responsibilities? Then conduct our responsibilities. And as individuals, this is the key. As individuals, We have a responsibility towards our society, whether we like it or not. As individuals of that society, whether we like it or not, we are responsible. We have duties towards our society.
So are we the most important people as youth?
I think that every part of society is important. I don't think that there is something special about... There is something special, but I don't think it gives it more importance, more significance. There's a difference between being important and being or having a specialty. Being special when you're old is the experience, like how I stated. Being special when you're in our age is that power, that motivation that you have. And being special when you're younger is that you are understanding, you are learning.
Yeah, you've got this open mind, you're like a sponge, you take everything.
Yeah.
Fair enough. People, for example, like the revolutions that were successful, or people who have had a lasting name, like Malcolm X, or...
Yeah, Martin Luther King, for example, or Sayyid al-Imam, the Islamic Revolution.
They never started when they were at... an old age, you know. They had that.
They had youth.
Yeah.
The youth were moving. They were like the troops, like how I stated. They were the troops, but who were the?
That's what I'm saying. I'm wondering, like that mind that they had it since they were young. One day,
they had. There's a, you know, what level of house are you?
Bidaya
al-Hikmah, right?
Yeah.
Before Bidayat al-Hikmah, you were studying Mantaq al-Mantaq, right?
Yeah.
Mantaq al-Mudhaffar, Hashiyat al-Abdallah, or Risala Shamsiyya.
Yeah, we're talking about logic and we're talking about philosophy.
Philosophy. So before philosophy, you study logic.
Yeah.
Before logic, how was your brain? You were smart. There's a difference between being smart and having that knowledge. Did you know about the word, for example, al-hamli al-sha'ih, for example?
Yeah.
Before that, even though you were smart, and you went into that book, you learned that. After learning it, then you were able to go up higher. Knowledge is like that. It gives you step by step. It's like you walk on this first step, you build the second step. Then you move on, you build the third step. You move on, you build the fourth step. The more you move, the higher you will go in knowledge, even though you're smart.
Does your aim and your goal, does that change?
Depends on people differ, you know. Sometimes that the aim was to become a philosopher, then all of a sudden you fall in love with fiqh. The aim was to defend, was to become in ilm al-kalam, for example, or theology, and then you fall in love with philosophy.
Hmm.
So it differs from people to people. Some people know from the beginning they had their own goal. So for example, like Sayyid al-Imam, he was from a knowledgeable family, actually, a family of knowledge. He had that smartness in him. He had that cleverness in him. But what made him Sayyid al-Imam?
Yeah.
Not only in political statuses, I'm talking about in usul.
The guy
is one of the greatest people to bring in, you know, some new theories inside the principles of fiqh. And you could see till this day that they are still discussing his theories and talking about his theories and understanding his theories and whatnot. So I think that the man was knowledgeable, but he gained more knowledge throughout his experience. That's what made him say to the Imam, experience.
Mm-hmm. And the youth stuck to him.
The views that he had, political views, because he was a student of a Sayyid al-Burujardi, of course.
Yeah.
And he had this connection with Sayyid al-Burujardi. Sayyid al-Burujardi was also, you know, a very clever man, even clever in politics. So he really did gain some knowledge from his teachers as well.
Was he aiming at the youth at that time?
Of course, you could see it through his words. He had a lot of aim through his words, for the youths, actually.
So if we look at it from another paradigm, we as youth right now should be looking for someone like Sayyid al-Imam to be after him, and, you know?
We have in this day.
So everyone should be doing that then?
Yeah, so to some points, yes, of course. And I think that there are, you know...
Like, if we do
we start
that...
Off, you know, we start off with this conception that we are... going to do this, and like how you stated that one might change. That first of all, like, I'm a troop. All I want to do is go fight, and I want to defend my land. I want to defend the domain of Islam.
And that's then, hypothetical. He's not actually a troop.
And then all of a sudden, because people are attacking our domain, whether it's being, you know, like in a war with mental war.
Yeah,
or
that
being
is
a,
what he is. Yeah.
Then all of a sudden you see that you have this potential in yourself. Sometimes other people see it in you, and they tell you, or you understand yourself, you ponder and reflect by yourself, that might change you. That might change you. It may change you into what? Into a person that, no, I want to become a leader. I want to be something bigger than a troop member. I want to be the person that moves the ummah.
But you start as a troop.
You started as a troop. So it differs. People, you know, but that's your youth. You have a goal, then it might change. You have your goal, it might stay the same.
So is it correct to say that as a person, as a youth, who wants to make a difference and who holds himself responsible for whatever goes on in the society, the first step for me is to look for a person who might guide me. Is that true? Or a leader, or a role model?
Yeah, of course. We always have to have a role model.
Is that the first step?
We always have to have it. And of course, the first role models, the first and foremost, are the Prophet and the Imam alayhi salam. Anyone else has to be on their path.
That's actually interesting that you say that, you know? Because those, the infallible Imams, they also held their responsibilities in different manners.
Exactly. Each one you could take a lesson from. The way Imam Sadiq was living, or Imam Askari alayhi salam was living in a tough situation of taqiyya, where the government was, you know, pressuring him, they had spies on him. The way that he reacted with that, the way that the safety of his companions was sometimes more important for him than, you know, specific manners.
He
even had to hide his own child, where he could not celebrate his child with his companions. And for example, or Imam Ar-Ridha alayhi salam, how he had to play politics. Sometimes you have to play politics with other politicians.
A few days back, I heard that the Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam, he actually cursed Zurara.
Yes, for his own good, actually.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That happens a lot from the Imam alayhi salam.
Yeah.
And the way that Zurara reacted was very beautiful, actually. What did he do? He did not send him, he did not go himself. He sent his son. He sent his son to him. To ask Imam Sadiq, what happened?
Yeah, what's going on?
What's going on? What did I do wrong? Please tell me.
Yeah.
And it was very respectful from Zurara towards the Imam alayhi salam. To send my son, because I might be done something wrong, the Imam doesn't want to talk to me.
Yeah, or see me.
Yeah, so he sent him and said that it was good for him that I cursed him. So it was in front of, you know, Zurara was one of those companions, the fiqh companions.
Yeah, he was a big man.
He was a big man, and he didn't want to bring too much, you know, ishara that he was a Shia. He didn't want to be pointed by the finger that he is a Shia. He is a follower of Imam Sadiq.
Yeah.
He has this ideology of at that time, they used to call him Ruwafid. To this time, they still call us Ruwafid anyways. Because they had this, you know, concept.
So that was it for this program. We were talking about youth and what we can do as youth in the society. From me and my brother Habib, till next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
My love, my life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are for you. Now I know how it's like to have your precious love in my life. Now I know how it feels to finally be at peace inside. That everybody knew how amazing it feels to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free. Set me free and made me strong.
The Limelight.
U.S. President Donald Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner bragged about Trump getting the country back from the doctors in an April interview with journalist Bob Woodward, a report says. The senior White House advisor boasted that the president was ignoring scientists and medical experts as the coronavirus pandemic unfolded, according to audio obtained by CNN. In a taped interview with the famed journalist on April 18, Kushner claimed U.S. was moving past the panic phase and pain phase of the pandemic and was at the beginning of the comeback phase. That doesn't mean there is not still a lot of pain, and there won't be pain for a while, but that basically was, we've now put out rules to get back to work, said Kushner. Trump's now back in charge. It's not the doctors. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stansil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, As COVID-19 Soars Ahead of Election, Tapes Reveal Kushner bragging about how Trump wrestled response back from doctors. Here's the details. As COVID-19 infection rates across the United States of America break records less than a week before the election day, newly released tape reveal how U.S. President Donald Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner privately bragged in mid-April that the president had successfully undermined the public health officials advising him on the unfolding coronavirus pandemic by committing to reopen the economy despite expert warnings. Trump is getting the country back from the doctors, Kushner boasted to journalist Bob Woodward in an April 18 interview, the audio which was obtained by CNN and released on Wednesday, October 28. At the time, the national caseload was growing by roughly 30,000 per day, while more than 40,000 Americans had already died from COVID-19. As CNN noted on Wednesday, October 28, Kushner's comments from 6 months ago look particularly damning as the U.S. undergoes a fall surge of infections. According to an Axios analysis of COVID-19 data, new coronavirus infections in the U.S. have soared to an all-time high just days ahead of November 3rd. The increase in cases has been accompanied by a rise in the U.S. pandemic death toll, which passed 227,000 on Thursday, October 29th. On average, Axios reported nearly 72,000 people tested positive for the coronavirus every day over the past week. The U.S. set a new record for the most cases in a single day twice in the past week, on its way to the highest seven-day average on record. In mid-April, Kushner told Woodward, "There were three phases. There is the panic phase, the pain phase, and then the comeback phase. I do believe that the last night symbolized kind of the beginning of the comeback phase. That doesn't mean there is not still a lot of pain, and there won't be pain for a while, but that basically was, we've now put out rules to get back to work. Trump's now back in charge. It's not the doctors. We have a negotiated settlement." Dr. Anthony Fauci acknowledged that there had been a pivot away from completely focusing on public health issues to looking at opening up the country with regard to the economy. "I don't know exactly the timing," the nation's top infectious disease expert and member of the White House Coronavirus Task Force told CNBC. "But it was clear some months ago." Kushner's statement, which critics say confirms that the Trump administration insisted on reopening the economy regardless of the advice offered by health experts and the deadly havoc it would wreak on the public because they thought it was politically beneficial, received widespread condemnation. "We know their handling the pandemic was dictated by politics, and that's a big part of the reason it was such an unmitigated disaster," wrote Washington Post columnist Paul Waldman on Wednesday, October 28. "But even more infuriating is that it was dictated by bad politics. They could have done the right thing for the wrong reasons, taking steps that would save lives solely to benefit President Trump's re-election campaign," Waldman added. "Instead, they did the wrong thing for the wrong reasons. They minimized the pandemic and undermined efforts to contain it because they thought doing so would be a political goldmine." On social media, epidemiologist Eric Figelding said on Thursday, October 28, that Kushner can go to hell for this comment. "If we continue our current behavior," CNN medical analyst Dr. Jonathan Rayner said, By the time they start to go down the other side of the curve, 500,000 people will be dead.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Around the world with reporters.
Violent clashes in Pakistani capital Islamabad. Police use heavy shelling to prevent thousands of angry protesters to march towards the French embassy in the capital. Protesters reach near the red zone after they forcibly removed heavy security barriers, one after the other on the road, leading towards the diplomatic enclave. At the heart of public anger is frequent incidents of blasphemy committed against the Prophet of Islam. Many protesters were injured in the violent clashes with the police. Over a dozen were also arrested.
This is just tip of the iceberg of a public anger against France. Protesters are saying that they are not going to settle down anything short of shutting down French embassy and expelling French ambassador from Islamabad.
French newspapers have repeatedly published blasphemous cartoons under the cover of freedom of speech. However, for Muslims in Pakistan and elsewhere, it was a politically motivated attempt to insult Islam, which, according to our Pew survey, is spreading across Europe. The official patronage to the blasphemers by the French government have added fuel to fire in Pakistan, like elsewhere in the Muslim world.
If someone speaks against the dignity and honor of Rasulullah alayhi salatu wasalam, then we will say, my mother, my father, my children, each and every one of them, I am ready to sacrifice them on the dignity and honor of Rasulullah alayhi salatu wasalam. Now we are not going to tolerate it anymore until and unless the ambassador of France would have been kicked out from Pakistan. We will be here, inshallah ta'ala.
When you abuse of Prophet, when you insult him, nauzubillah, and then when you keep doing it again and again, then we'll definitely respond. Everybody in this world will respond if you keep hurting their sentiments.
In retaliation to controversial remarks of French president against Islam, protesters insulted his images. Anti-France sentiments have surged suddenly at an unprecedented level after repeated incidents of blasphemy of Islam. Similar protests were also held across Pakistan. Like elsewhere in the Muslim world, people have started boycotting French products in Pakistan. Prime Minister Imran Khan says that France under President Macron is encouraging Islamophobia, which is creating further polarization and marginalization of Muslims in the West, that he believes would inevitably lead towards radicalization in the world. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Out.
outside the French embassy in London, angered British Muslims gathered to vent their frustrations. The protest comes amid rising violence in France over the ongoing debate of freedom of speech versus freedom to insult.
This is just one of the many protests taking place across the Muslim world. Muslims are indeed angry over what they say is deep insult by Western society led by France against Islam and its holiest figures. France claims that it's defending freedom of speech, but Muslims say that they feel indiscriminately persecuted in France and are targeted relentlessly by Western political leaders and by media sources too.
The focus of the anger was squarely pointed on the French president for his passionate defense of anti-Islam insults.
First and foremost, he needs to apologize and he needs to make a law that freedom of speech should have some limits. This is not freedom of speech. If I come and say to your father, if I start swearing at him, do you think that is freedom of speech? That's not. In the whole world, there are 1.7 billion Muslims. They will be ready to sacrifice their life in the name of Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. That the message should be very clear.
However, protesters also made clear why defending the Prophet is so important.
It insults us, it insults the entire Ummah, the entire 1.7, if not more, billion people around the globe, because our Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam is closer to our hearts. He is more dear to us than the entire world, our family, our parents, children, whoever it may be. Anyone in this world does not compare to our Prophet beloved Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam.
Not only is it just disrespectful, it's just the mere fact that I wouldn't do that to anyone else in religion, or mock it in any kind of form, or like, let alone do such an outrageous move, especially if you're in such a position of power. It's not only just disrespectful, it makes me feel quite hurt.
And the fact they disrespected us while doing nothing, this is really disrespectful. And that's why we're here. We're here to prove that we're here for our Prophet. Because without our Prophet, we're nothing. We wouldn't be Muslims. And I'm very proud to be Muslim. Alhamdulillah. The Prophet means everything. And the Prophet must mean everything. Because I adore him more than my mom, my dad, my siblings, everyone that I'd love. Because he is the reason that I'm Muslim. He is the reason that I'm going to go to Jannah, heaven. He is everything to me.
Muslim resentment against France is still growing. Will Macron finally back down or choose to stand by his anti-Islam policies? The answer for now still remains unclear. Robert Carter, London.
Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah strongly denounced the latest crime committed in France while stressing that Islam prohibits the killing of the innocent. He said all Muslims agree on glorifying and defending the dignity of Prophet Muhammad, yet they reject blaming every individual crime on Islam.
It's wrong for France or any other side to put the blame for a crime committed by a specific person on a person's religion, or to put the blame on the followers of the same religion of the person who committed the crime. If the criminal is a Muslim, no one has the right to put the blame on Islam, or to put the blame on Muslims, whether in France or anywhere else in the world.
Hezbollah's leader called on France to reevaluate their stances and policies to see where they are responsible for the current crimes.
There's a Takfiri terrorist ideology which endorses killing for mere differences in religion, ideology, politics, or disagreements on any detail, and they commit monstrous crimes. You protected this ideology, the Americans, the U.S. administration, the French officials, the European officials. You protected them. You gave them all your support. You facilitated their infiltration into Syria and Iraq. You helped fund and arm these groups until they had fighting capabilities. Now you're surprised that their groups have beheaded people?
Observers stress that it is the same policy that created Daesh that is now creating that hatred against Islam.
The West needs to see what they made. They made the groups that behead people and bomb churches and mosques, that kidnap and massacre people. They made them, and they are the ones moving them and giving them media coverage and conferences and funding them. And even before the creation of these terrorist groups like Daesh, the biggest terrorist act in human history committed by the West was establishing Israel in the region on the land of Palestine. That was the basis of all terror.
Lebanon has been one of the countries where anger is mounting over France's anti-Islam rhetoric. Protesters held a rally facing the residence of the French ambassador, denouncing the French president's defense of offensive caricatures of Prophet Muhammad.
Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said France and the West harbor the same Takfiri terrorism, which is committing crimes in Europe and all over the world. Sayed Nasrallah called on France to address the roots of the problem instead of making anti-Islam accusations. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Violence has surged across Afghanistan over the past weeks, with attacks and blasts killing hundreds of civilians in the country. Based on a recent UN report, some 6,000 Afghan civilians were killed or maimed in Afghanistan within last 8 months. The UN blames the Taliban for the violence and for much of the civilian casualties, just as the Afghan government holds the militant group responsible. The armed wings of the Afghan government stressed that they are trying their best regarding their missions and responsibilities to protect civilians. Afghan locals also praised the efforts of Afghan military forces in pounding terrorists. But in the meantime, they blamed the U.S. for not properly implementing the bilateral security agreement between Kabul and Washington. The bilateral security agreement was signed between Afghanistan and the United States back in September 2014. Now, many Afghans name the deal as ineffective regarding the security situation in the country. This is one of the reasons behind people's call for the revocation of the agreement.
The agreement has proved to be futile and ineffective on the security situation in Afghanistan. Terrorist groups are challenging Afghan forces in different fronts across the country, despite the strong resistance of government troops.
I think it's better for our government to pull out of the agreement because it has proved to be not in line with our interests so far. The rising violence and war claim the lives of our beloved ones on a daily basis.
Some others also argued that the silence of Washington regarding Pakistan's frequent rocket attacks on some border provinces of Afghanistan also contradicts with the bilateral security agreement, as it holds the U.S. responsible to support Afghanistan against such foreign attacks.
Under the agreement, the United States is committed to support Afghanistan if the country faces any serious external threat to its territory, but we have not seen any reaction of Washington to repeated Pakistani rocket attacks on our eastern provinces.
Although the deal highlights U.S. responsibilities in confronting foreign threats, it's better not to rely on such deals. The history has shown that players like the U.S. have always been after their own interests.
President Ashraf Ghani's government signed a deal with hope and optimism, as the agreement seemed promising for country's security. Almost 7 years later, some key political leaders in Afghanistan, including former President Hamid Karzai, unanimously described the bilateral security agreement with the U.S. as a futile platform as the country faces an increase in violence. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Tufts University has recently published a report that compares the rate at which Americans aged between 18 and 29 have voted in U.S. elections in recent years. The report shows that the age group's participation has gradually increased, reaching its highest in 2018. The growth also was observed in key swing states, which can prove decisive in who will enter the Oval Office and control the Senate. Experts believe the rise in voting among young Americans is due to the rejection of the policy adopted by U.S. politicians.
The Pew Research Center poll saying already that this generation, 77% of them, rejected Trump policies, even back in January. So, of course, there's reason to suspect that what happened to all of us in the last months is going to, that number is going to be equal or larger.
Official data suggests that although the age segment has the least share in the number of voters in U.S. elections, 46% of eligible voters aged between 18 and 29 went to the polls in the 2016 presidential election. Several other polls have confirmed that the enthusiasm to vote is growing stronger among the young American population.
I think there's been a lot of effort to mobilize young voters this year, but also in the past couple of years, because we've seen a lot of different issues come on the scene that are important to young